Now, I will try to give you part of what you missed by not having Manley's Bible Handbook, this book that we're not using. Part of what I'm going to say is what you would have gotten out of that if you'd had that book to read. And part of it is an expansion and illustration of some of the material that is in the syllabus. We'll take up three things if we have time: the languages, text, and canon of the Bible. Now, that is easily worth three periods. We'll try to do it in one. First of all, languages. I heard of a dear old lady somewhere who objected to modern versions of the Bible, and she said the King James Version was good enough for Paul and Silas, and it's good enough for me. Evidently, quite unaware that Paul and Silas spoke Greek and never saw the King James Version. It wasn't made till about 1,600 years after their time. Now, it is very obvious to us, of course, the Bible is a translated book. No part of it was originally written in English. This is a translated book. And therefore, it is necessary for a really accurate knowledge of the Bible to know something about the language or languages in which it was originally written. The major languages are two: the Old Testament in Hebrew, the New Testament in Greek. When the New Testament was written, after the time of Jesus Christ, Greek was a world language in the old world. It was the second language to millions of people who had some other language for their first language, but more widely known than any other one language. And so this was a natural for getting the Christian gospel spread around in a language that would communicate with people. Now, the Old Testament is different. This is in Hebrew. This is a member of the Semitic family of languages. English, you see, is a member of a different family. Five major families of languages. And English belongs to the Indo-European family, to which Latin, Greek, German, some of the languages of India also belong. But Hebrew, the Semitic group, of which the most prominent living language today is Arabic, spoken by many millions in many countries in various slightly different dialects. Semitic languages whose original home seems to have been a belt across northern Africa and across the Near East, the area of Arabia and Iraq and into Iran. Now, I'll give you a sample of Hebrew after a bit. Some parts of the Old Testament, just a fraction, are written in a different language called variously Aramaic, Aramean, Syriac, or Syrian. In the Bible called usually Syriac or Syrian. This is the language that at one time was spoken around Damascus, north of Palestine. The preferable name would be Aramean, but Aramaic is the commonest used one. A cognate language to Hebrew. This would be related to Hebrew about as English is to, let's say, Swedish or German. If you could go back by time machine to the Neolithic age, several thousand B.C., 6,000 or 7,000 maybe, you would reach a point where Hebrew and Aramaic were identical. They originally must have been one, but they branched, and in the historic period, these had separated far enough that the person who was raised on one couldn't understand the other unless he had studied it as a foreign language and learned it that way. Now, one of my former students put this gem on a completion type quiz. The Old Testament is written in Hebrew, all except a few chapters in Daniel and Ezra, which are written in Aramaic. This I marked zero because he didn't say whether it was peppermint or spearmint. Aramaic. It's not Aramaic, it's Aramaic. Now, the Hebrew language is quite different from ours. The alphabet is related to ours, however, 22 letters as a consonant, and the structure of it is simpler than English. Hebrew would be as dead as a dodo today, if not better. It was for hundreds of years a dead language, known only to scholars, as Latin has come to be. Do you know anybody that can speak Latin? Some, a few, I believe, Catholic priests have learned how to speak Latin. This isn't common even among them, to speak Latin. They can read Latin and use it for a ritual or a mass or something, but to speak Latin for ordinary conversation. As far as I know, Latin isn't the everyday language in which you pay your electric bill or buy a newspaper anywhere in the world, not even in Vatican City. Latin is the language of scholars only today, and it's not the main language of anybody. At Vatican City, even they use Italian for ordinary conversation. Now, the Republic of Israel, the present-day Republic of Israel, since 1947, when it got independence, has been promoting a program to revive the Hebrew language with great success. It's taught in all their elementary and secondary schools. They have movies, television, radio, magazines, newspapers, and books, all in Hebrew, and are doing this with great success. The Republic of Ireland, or ERA, Southern Ireland, is trying to revive the Irish or ancient Irish language, and with some success, but I think we will have to award the Jews the first prize for reviving a dead language. That's Hebrew. Now, the material that the earliest books of the Bible were written on, the most anciently used material, as far as we know, was clay tablets. But the Bible, no part of it was originally written on those, as far as we know. Papyrus. This is something like paper. It was used as we use paper until paper itself was introduced from China in the Middle Ages of the Christian era. Manufacture of paper is a Chinese invention. A papyrus made from the pith of a tall reed that grows in swamp and shallow water on the edges of the Nile River at some places and in a few other places in the world. This pith is gotten out of the stem and laid out in strips on a flat table or surface. Some gum or mucilage of some kind is spread thinly on that, and then another layer is crosswise at right angles to the first layer of strips of this pith. And this is pressed down with a heavy weight and forms a solid sheet, which when dried can be written on with a brush-type pen. Not very durable. Papyrus had the great advantage of being cheap, and for this reason was used all over the Mediterranean world for about 1,000 years or more, because it was cheap. But papyrus just is very fragile. It's about as strong as blotting paper and about as durable as that. And it's, of course, an organic product and therefore subject to decay. And papyrus has perished everywhere practically except in Egypt, where the atmospheric humidity is so low that bacteria just don't have a chance. And this explains also why in Egypt wooden objects have survived from 1,000 years before Christ. Chairs, tables, bedsteads, and boxes, and other things made of wood. Wooden things in Babylonia, in the Euphrates Valley, have decayed to a film like a spider web. Touch it and it vanishes. But in Egypt, the air is so dry that these things have been preserved. This is also partly why the mummies or embalmed bodies of the kings and so forth have been preserved, because the air in Egypt is so dry. Rainfall is said to be about 0.5 inch a year. And I suppose the air is as dry in Egypt as it is anywhere in the world where people live. Now, papyrus, very perishable, but the large amounts of it have been recovered from Egypt with writing on it. The earliest manuscript fragments that we have of any part of the New Testament are on papyrus. Not complete books, but parts, pages, and pieces. But these come from the 100 AD, and are the earliest witnesses to the text of the New Testament. Now, papyrus hunting has become quite a practice for archaeologists, and there was an archaeologist in Egypt who was looking for papyrus manuscripts and thought he knew where to find them. He had a clue or a hint, or a hunch maybe, and went to dig. Digging is fairly easy in Egypt. In most places, the soil is very sandy. So he was starting to dig where he thought that some of these things could be found underground. And to his great disgust, dug into a cemetery of embalmed sacred crocodiles. A crocodile in ancient Egypt before Christian times was worshipped as a god, one of their collection of gods, divine, the divine crocodile, and had to be treated with proper respect even when dead. So the crocodiles were properly embalmed by the morticians of Egypt and buried with proper rites, no doubt, in the crocodile cemetery. This fellow dug into this looking for papyrus. And he was, about 20 years ago, he was so disgusted that he picked up one of these crocodiles by the tail like that and whammed it on the ground, and it broke in two. And he found that inside it was completely stuffed with rolls of papyrus. And so were all the rest of them in that cemetery. They had removed the innards of the crocodile at the time of embalming, and I don't know what they did with those, buried them maybe, but stuffed them with rolls of papyrus, and these had writing on. They were not really early. They were from the Greek period, about 200 B.C., after Alexander the Great, you see. But they had government records on them, records of taxpayers and taxes collected, and all sorts of census records and other government archives. These were the Pentagon Papers of ancient Egypt that had been declassified and put in the inside of the crocodile. Now, this was papyrus and the commonest writing material and used for all inexpensive writing for a long time. The next is parchment. This is leather. And parchment is an animal product. Usually they use goat skin or sheep skin. Some of the Dead Sea Scrolls that I'll mention in a bit are on antelope skin. The leather, cleaned and smoothed and bleached and stitched together in sections so it can be rolled up on a spindle and written on. This is much more durable than papyrus. On the other hand, parchment is an animal product and therefore also subject to decay. Now, no doubt the first books of the Bible as written by Moses were written either on papyrus or on parchment rolls. I have a sample here of a Hebrew scroll. This is not full size. Incidentally, it has, in this case, the scripture has been broken by accident. We'll have to scotch tape this and fix it. This was given to me by a Jewish student in the college. He came from Freedom, Mr. Sidney Baller. He ran a little butcher shop, a meat store in Freedom, and he came to Geneva besides, and he became a school teacher. He was not a Christian, but he took the Bible courses in Geneva and said he got something from them, and he gave me this item. This is a sort of a curio and gift item. A real scroll like used in the synagogue would be much larger than this and would be on in ancient times, on parchment. Maybe they make some of them on special paper today, I don't know. This is on rather thin paper, and it's photographically reproduced, and it would strain the eyes even of a rabbi to read very much of this, I'm sure. It's the whole five books of Moses, I believe. And if this were completely unrolled, it would fit clear across the front of this classroom. Now, you have to be a bit careful to hold it right side up. I'll test this out, and you may look at it. Please don't take time to read the truth. Just glance at it and test it on.
This is certainly true. I'll make part of the sentence with cereal. You might like to know what Hebrew sounds like. Now, I can tell you that Jews themselves don't agree on how to pronounce Hebrew. The Jews, some Poland pronounce it one way, and those from Spain pronounce it a different way. And there's other options besides that. So how are common folks like you and I going to pronounce Hebrew? However, since I'm not very scared of any of you correcting my pronunciation of it, although it has an attempt at
first few verses of Genesis, where it says, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. About five verses here. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz. V'ha-aretz ha-yadagohu v'abohu v'choshek al-panei tachon. Ruach Elohim reshefet al-panei ha-mayim. V'yomer Elohim yehi or, v'yehi or, v'yar Elohim ha-or ki tov. V'yehi erev, v'yehi boker yom echad. I hope you understood that. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning one day. All right. Now then, Hebrews, the Bible, let's say, as God inspired the original writers to write it, was written with consonants only, 22 consonants and no vowels. You just had to guess at the vowels, or you had to learn them with a teacher, or know them from having heard it read before. This is not as bad as you might think. If I would write up here, now, you're out of you, I'm sure you can miss some time. What is so bad? Neighbor talk, see you right off. And Hebrew is like that, it's a consonant. And the young people and children learn to read Hebrew, they learn to read it from just the consonant. And I suppose we can learn to read English that way if we start out that way. And this didn't bother anybody as long as Hebrew was a spoken language that people spoke in their daily life. They just knew how to pronounce it, what vowels you put in there, A-E-I-O-U or Y. You know. The time came, however, when Hebrew had become a dead language and nobody spoke it for everyday life anymore. And there was a real danger that the knowledge of how to pronounce it would be forever lost. And so in the early centuries of the Christian era, a large and long-continuing committee of Jewish scholars, the Masoretes, nobody knows the real literal meaning of that word, got together and worked out a system of vowels. They also found that the existing manuscripts had some slight variations, and they compared manuscript with manuscript and made a judgment and decided which one was correct. And put out a standardized text of the Hebrew scriptures. Now, they worked out a system of vowels, a little sign like that puts underneath or between or above the line. And this, for instance, would be a broad A like in quarter. This would be a short A like in half. Got like that there would be U like in the unity, dot underneath would be an I like in machine, and so on. These are called points. And you buy a Hebrew Bible in a store that sells them to study, it has these points in it. It makes it much easier to learn and to read, of course, and know how to pronounce it from these. The Hebrew scroll that is used in a synagogue for religious worship, and this one is being passed around the room. It has no point, only the content. This is the text that God gave it. Now, this is of some importance to us. You realize when we say that the Old Testament is the inspired and infallible Word of God, strictly speaking, this applies to the Old Testament as God gave it, and that means just the consonants. These points were added more than 2,000 years later. 2,000 years after the oldest part of the Old Testament, after Moses, and more than 1,000 years after the newest part. And the men who put these in were the best scholars of their day, but they were certainly not infallibly directed in putting in the A, E, I, O, U. And so it is possible that this pointing may be mistaken in some places. However, modern day biblical scholars are almost universally agreed that the Masoretes were right. not only nearly all the time, but practically 100% of the time, much more than 99%. There's only a rare place, maybe one in thousands of verses, where we could possibly change the little points that they put in and pronounce it with a different set of vowels and get a perhaps more correct meaning. Just a few places like this. And almost everywhere, to a certain degree, the mastery knew what they were doing.
Now, so much for the Old Testament in Hebrew. They copied these manuscripts. You see, Moses or whoever it was wrote the original. And in the New Testament, the apostles and other writers of the book wrote the original. Now, the original manuscripts are called autographs, autographs or autographs, written with the hand of the inspired writer or his secretary working right with him. These are all lost. There isn't a single one or a part of anyone in the world known to exist today. And I think I can explain why they are lost. The Xerox machine hadn't been invented. They had to copy them by hand. It took a scribe maybe a whole year to copy the entire books of what we call the Old Testament. This was done by highly trained Jewish scholars, both before and after the beginning of the Christian era. And the New Testament books in Greek and later in Latin were done by monks, mostly in monasteries in Europe and the Near East in the Middle Ages. These men also highly qualified and specially trained for their job of copying. Now, Jewish scribes were the strictest in their rules about copying. They knew the number of letters in each book of the Bible, the Old Testament. Shown so many thousand letters, consonants, in the book of Genesis. And when a scribe had made a new copy from an old one, they counted the letters in this. And if it was correct, okay. If it was off, if he had one or two too many or too few, they allowed him to search through it and find the place where the error was and make a correction. But if more than two, three or more, they threw it away and had to make a new one. How would you like Geneva's English department to adopt this rule on research and themes and research papers, themes and term papers? Two mistakes in spelling or punctuation and you pass. Three mistakes, you throw it away, get zero, and write another one. Well, I'm sure this would be highly unpopular. I think the student senate would take it up if the English department would try this. And the Bible department, horrors, no. But anyway, this is how accurate they were. Now, you see, not quite as accurate as the Xerox machine, but pretty nearly. When they were so finicky in particular as that, they got copies that were virtually letter perfect. And this meant there was no motive left to preserve the originals. What do you need the original for if you've got an exact copy of it? And therefore, the originals would be used until they wore out. Go to pieces after a while, can't be used anymore, and then they would be disposed of in some way. Sometimes they buried them, they even held funerals for them sometimes, but they got rid of them and depended on the copy. So what we have today are copies of copies of copies of copies, been copied X number of times from the original. But this has been done with exceedingly great care. All right, the Dead Sea Scrolls ought to have a brief mention here. That is the Dead Sea, the lowest place on the surface of the earth. The surface of the water is 1,290 feet below sea level, almost 1,600 feet. It varies a little bit from year to year. And the Jordan River flows in it. The water is so salty, you can't sink in it. You can drown. In an undignified posture with your feet up and your head down, but you can't sink. You go there and want to come back and brag to your American friends, you dipped in the Dead Sea, you do it this way. And you go in that water, you can't control yourself unless you're used to being in water that deep, that's heavy. And if you don't drown and get out, you have the most powerful, intolerable itch. And nothing can be done about it till you go to Jerusalem, 24 miles away and 3,700 feet up in the air, to a hotel which will allow you enough water for a very moderate shower at 6 hours a day.
Now this area here is some rocky cliffs. Almost nothing grows except a little sparse grass.
It's a desolate, forsaken, virtually uninhabited area. To that place, somewhat before the time of Christ, a colony of Jews went who considered the Jerusalem Jews too liberal. They wanted to be stricter, and they believed that the end of the world was coming very soon. And they went out there to the edge of nowhere on the shores of the Dead Sea to await the end of the world. The end of the world for them came when the Roman army broke it up. And they had to hide their books. This order was extremely strict. We'll have something about maybe next semester. How would you like to live in a community where if you got mad and blew your top once, they would put you on half your food for a whole year? Get a half a meal. They only ate twice a day anyhow. A half a breakfast and half a dinner for a whole year. That would lead a person, I think, to count 10 before they would show any denunciation. All right, in this forsaken place, in 1947, an Arab goat herd was looking for a lost goat and couldn't find it. And he saw it. He didn't live there, but he was passing goats on the sandy grass there. And he saw a hole in the rock and threw a stone in. The goat wasn't in there, but it made a hollow noise and something cracked. And he went in and found a row of pottery jars about 14 inches high with the wide mouth tops and about as big as a saucer, and sealed with the black decomposition of some kind, and this stone had broken one of those. This fellow was illiterate, completely ignorant. He had no idea what he'd found. He hoped to find gold or silver, and it was only writing, but he peddled two or three of these scrolls to an antique dealer in Bethlehem, which was the nearest place of any size. And later they came in the hands of scholars, Dr. Albright of Johns Hopkins University, who died just lately here, the Dean of American Biblical Archaeologists, pronounced them genuine, said it was the greatest manuscript discovery of modern times, and that they came from about just before the time of Christ. That these scrolls have nothing to do with Christianity. They only show a little bit of the background of the world in which Christianity originated. Now, two of these were manuscripts of the book of Isaiah. Later they found many more in other caves in that area and in the same cave. They had one of the original scholars that saw these, Geneva, he lectured. He had pieces of the Dead Sea Scrolls. He must have touched them, but he must have looked at them. And Dr. Creever, Trevor Creever. Anyway, one copy of the book of Isaiah, complete, all 66 chapters, except part of the first chapter was worn off at the beginning of the roll. Another copy of the book of Isaiah, not quite complete. Now, the oldest we had before this, the oldest surviving manuscripts of the Hebrew scriptures were from the 800, about 900 A.D. Between 800 and 900 A.D. That was the oldest. All the ones before that they'd been copied from, you see, had perished. And here were the Dead Sea Scrolls from 100 B.C. Radiocarbon method was one way of establishing this date. This does not give an exact date, but it gives a range within which the date will fall. Almost 1,000 years older than the oldest previously known surviving copy. And when they were compared, while they were not found to be absolutely identical, they were found to be almost identical. So nearly so that it was very remarkable and a very high tribute to the extreme accuracy with which the ones in Europe and the Near East in libraries and so forth and churches have been copied and copied and copied down through the ages. Check them back by one written 1,000 years before
and the differences are so trivial they're hardly worth mentioning, only a place or two where they make any real difference. Now that's about the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Jews got along fine with their Bible in Hebrew as long as they were living in Palestine. But the time came when they were in large numbers living in other places. In the first place, as a result of war, there were mass deportations to other places, Babylon and so forth, and many never came back from those places. They kept on living there, and their descendants after them. And also, at a somewhat later time, many Jews began to migrate to other countries for business and commercial reasons. Better ways to get ahead in the world than to raise barley on a stony hillside, you know. And so there were Jews in all the great port cities of the Mediterranean world. Corinth, Alexandria, Marseille, France, Massilia, that is, and numerous others. These people originally could speak Hebrew, but their grandchildren couldn't. Now, my grandfather came from Holland, and he spoke Dutch to the end of his life. I cannot speak Dutch. I cannot read Dutch. I can barely figure it out enough to recognize that it is Dutch, not English. And I wouldn't venture to try to speak it to anybody that knows how. It's just too much sense to try. Probably quite a number of you had grandparents or great-grandparents that came to this country from somewhere and spoke some other language, and yet English is your language. So there came to be a generation of Jewish people who couldn't read Hebrew and couldn't understand it if they heard it read. And so the Hebrew scriptures were translated into Greek. Now this was done, first of all, four great translations of the Old Testament made into Greek in ancient times. The first of these is by far the most important, the Septuagint, LXX or 70, made in Alexandria, Egypt. The Jewish account of this is as follows. Historians doubt this, but it may be true, at least the first part of it may very likely be true. A king in Egypt named Ptolemy Philadelphus, Ptolemy the lover of brotherhood. He was a Greek, and he was one of the successors of Alexander the Great, and ruled in Egypt. We know what he looked like because we have coins with his picture on. Incidentally, he was overweight, should have minded his calories. Ptolemy Philadelphus was a collector of scriptures. Some people collect just stamps, you know, and some collect little china dogs or teacups. Well, Ptolemy collected Bibles. He didn't believe them all, but he collected them. He had a collector's interest. And he wanted the Jewish scriptures for his collection in the Greek language, however, that he could read. And being a king, he had plenty of money at his disposal, and he financed the translation of the Old Testament into Greek, according to this account. Imported 70 learned scholars from Jerusalem to Alexandria, and they produced the Septuagint, or the first translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. It became extremely influential in the ancient world. Now, the story up to that point may be true. See what you think of the conclusion of it. The story continues. They divided these 70 scholars up into 35 pairs of two, and set each pair up in a separate house, and gave them writing materials and told them to go to work. So 35 committees of two, each isolated from all the others, produced 35 independent translations of the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek, and when the job was done, they let them all out and compared the product, and they were all word for word identical. Now that seems to me to be a little bit hard to believe. There are those who say that the whole story is a piece of Jewish state of speaking, however, not necessarily. If the first part of it may be correct. The Septuagint was the first Bible of the Christian church. It became the Bible of the Jewish faith everywhere except in Palestine, and even there some people used it. It also became extremely influential with the more serious-minded type of Greeks, Romans, and other people who were not Jews, who were disillusioned and completely fed up with the old religion of Jupiter and Juno and Apollo and all that business, and who were hungry for something better. A world in which suicide was terribly common. Maybe 60% of the people were slaves. A world in which millions lived without hope. This is awful, you know. There was found in Egypt, among those papyrus documents, a letter from a Roman official in Egypt to his wife. He was away on business. He was at home, expecting the birth of a baby. And he writes this letter, and it was discovered on a papyrus document, full of the most endearing, lovey-dovey language. And then, he says, when the baby is born, if it's a boy, save it alive. If it's a girl, take it out of town and abandon it along the roadside. Now, this practice was common in the pagan world. The Jewish faith and the Christian faith protested against this as wicked and inhuman. But it was common and not even thought a sin by the pagan people. Now then, here comes a book which brings something better. A beacon light of truth and of hope and of righteousness. And it became extremely influential. Now that's the Septuagint, the first translation in Greek. Just in our remaining 5 minutes, something about the original Bible in Latin. Nobody knows who made the first translations of any part of the Bible into Latin. The evidence indicates that many people tried their hand at this, and most of them didn't know how to do it. It was amateurish and unsatisfactory. Now, there's reason for that. For the first 200 years of its existence, from the year 100 up to about 300, the church was undergoing intense persecution. There's a picture up there of the Colosseum in Rome. It's like a big arena, football field, stadium. And there are Christians tied to the lampposts all around being burned to death. And out in the middle, a group of people, right inside there, a group of people, we may want to look at it closer later. A man standing up to pray, the rest of them sitting there kneeling. I believe there's one woman there holding a baby. This is an artist's painting, of course, but at the left, lions and tigers being released from an underground pit that will kill and eat these people. This is the penalty for being a Christian in the latter period there of the Roman Empire. Now, when you're living under that kind of conditions and with that kind of danger and that kind of a threat hanging over your head, this is not conducive to scholarly activity. And it's no wonder that the translations of the New Testament that were made were not very satisfactory. Well, come the year 400, the persecution was over. The Roman Empire had become nominally Christianized. I don't think it was very Christian, but at least nobody was killing Christians for their faith anymore. And the Bishop of Rome, later called the Pope, I don't think he was called the Pope at that time, but the Bishop of Rome said, we absolutely have to have a better translation of the Bible in Latin. The condition of what they had was chaotic, and it was full of contradictory translations, and it just wouldn't do. So he commissioned a man named Jerome, Hieronymus, or Jerome, St. Jerome, this is about the year 400, to translate the Bible into Latin. Jerome was one of maybe half a dozen men in the Christian world of that day that could have done it. He had to know three languages. Two to translate from and one to translate to, Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. There were plenty of people who knew two of those, but you had to know three. And Christians who knew Hebrew were almost non-existent. Jerome was one who had studied Hebrew, and so he was a real scholar. His views on sex and marriage you wouldn't agree with, and neither would I, but he was extremely ascetic about this. He considered marriage an evil to be gotten along with as little as you can. Anyway, he was a great Bible translator, though. And he didn't want the job. Jerome tried as hard as he could to get excused from doing this. He said to the Pope, look here, this is a thankless job. No matter what changes I make in the text of the translation of the Latin version of the Scriptures, how absolutely necessary they are and how fully they can be justified. All right, people are going to curse me for daring to change the sacred words that they learned at their mother's knee and for tampering with the Word of God. I don't want to do it. But he was told it was his job, he was to do it, so he did it. Said, I'll never be able to do it in Rome. Too much going on. So he left Rome and went to Palestine, to Bethlehem, where Jesus was born. This is how you get away from it all. And bought a house and collected manuscripts, all he could get from all parts of the Jewish and Christian world of his day. He paid out money to a Jewish scholar to teach him more Hebrew, although he already had studied Hebrew. And then he went to work. Now, he had some help, but he did most of it himself. And he worked years at it and produced the translation of the entire Bible, Old and New Testament, into Latin. It was called the Vulgate. This is an unfortunate name because it makes you think of the word vulgar right away, and there's nothing vulgar about it. It's a monument of Christian scholarship. It has been revised twice since Jerome's day, but still as substantially as he put it out. Now, the first copies were sent to Rome, and then more copies made and sent other places all over the world of that day. The very thing that Jerome was afraid of happened. People that didn't have 1/50th of his scholarship said, this man has his nerve to tamper with the Word of God and change the sacred words of the Scriptures. And Jerome kept his cool. He didn't argue with him. He just kept his cool. And later he was vindicated, mostly after he was dead, however. And it came to be recognized that what he had put out was so much better than anything they had ever had before that it replaced the previous ones completely. And nobody even bothered to keep a single copy of the old Latin version for scholars in later times to use. You can't get one today, just fragments. Ireland was never part of the Roman Empire, and some of the Gospels in Ireland have survived in an old Latin version prior to the Vulgate. And for the rest, it's been an attempt to reconstruct it by patchwork quotations and little bits picked up here and there. You can get sort of a job like this. But Jerome's Vulgate stands today as the standard translation in Latin. Now, don't you ever say the King James Version was good enough for Paul and Silas. It isn't always good enough for us, although I use it and I like it.